This is the end, my only friend, the end of our elaborate plans, the end of everything that stands, the end, no safety or surprise, the end.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And it does seem that given that the president of Syria lost his defense minister, his brother-in-law, and the head of his crisis team in a suicide bombing at a meeting in the National Security Headquarters in Damascus, that's about as close a blow to the heart of the regime as you could get, isn't it?
Yes, it's very much so. We still don't know what the blast, what caused the blast. There's talk of suicide bombers. There's talk about it having been placed there by one of the drivers. And we still don't know who did it. There are two groups claiming responsibility. But whoever did it obviously got very, very close into the inner sanctum of the regime, which is should be frightening for the Assads and the people around them.
So the two groups are the Free Syrian Army and a jihadist group calling itself Lord of the Martyrs Brigade. Are they the two that you're referring to?
Yes, absolutely. Now, the Free Syrian Army is, for your listeners should know, is not an army per se. It's a series of local militias that is extraordinarily decentralized and maybe not under anybody's direct control as well.
Well, it seems, though, I mean, I know that you can't. I had somebody on from the Syrian coordinating committees yesterday, who's the English language spokesman for the local coordinating committees inside of Syria. And of course, you know, when you talk to the opposition just as much as you talk with the government, you have to be a little skeptical. But the long and the short of it is that it seems that there's still a possibility that this could have been something that the regime did. I mean, is that too paranoid and too conspiratorial? I mean, they're capable of doing weird stuff, and suddenly the alacrity with which they've announced the replacement to the defense minister is pretty strange, but maybe not.
They wanted to demonstrate continuity for sure, and that's why they quickly were able to appoint a new defense minister, the general whose responsibility for going against Idlib in the north. I wouldn't put the regime, I think it is very, very paranoid to look at it in this way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been reading the Arabic language newspapers from all sorts of sides, and we get this sort of thing coming out all the time. For example, there were groupings in Lebanon who actually claimed that this was done by the regime itself to put more blame on the Salafists so that the regime would be able to circle its wagons. Again, I think that that is overly paranoid. I think that the regime took quite a hit today, and I don't think that the regime would have done this to itself.
And the fact that the fact that General Asaf Shawkat, who's married to Assad's sister Bushra, he didn't get into a family squabble and one of the, I think it was Assad's brother that died, shot him in the stomach some time back. Do you know that story?
Yes, this was supposed to have taken place at a family meal. The Assads themselves weren't particularly enamored by Shawkat when he first entered into their lives. He came from a fairly middling background. He wasn't the sort of person that they wanted to have in their lives. And there were rumors that he was going to marry Bushra or propose to Bushra for the money and for the access. But what's happened subsequent to that is that he has proved to be probably the key player in the national security team. he is the deputy defense minister. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but he actually had far more power than the defense minister had. He was the person who was overseeing the military intelligence services. And for those of you who know anything about Syria, the particularly the Air Force intelligence is considered to be probably the most powerful and the most vicious of the intelligence services. If you remember back to the murder of the boy, Hamza al-Khatib, for example, that was Air Force intelligence that was responsible for that. Remember, Hafez al-Assad himself came out of the Air Force.
And, of course, that incident with the boy in many ways propelled this this revolution against, or this what now the Red Cross is now describing as a civil war. Again, I'm speaking with James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA, who's a specialist on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria. His latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. The White House today came out with a statement to James saying it's clear that the Assad regime is losing control of Syria. There is real momentum against Assad with increasing defections and a strengthened and more united opposition that is operating across the country. I guess no great revelations there, but they've been saying for some time that Assad's going to go, right?
Yeah, they have. At a certain point, Hillary Clinton predicted a coup d'etat. That's more wishful thinking than sound foreign policy analysis, actually. I very much appreciate your playing Jim Morrison before this segment, that this is the end, but I'm not quite sure that we can, at this point, kiss goodbye to the Assad regime, and there's several reasons for that. The opposition is not united, as the Obama administration says. It's highly factionalized. There are groupings within it that hate other groupings within it. In addition to that, just as the events of today might cause people to reassess their commitment to the Assad regime, it also might force people to circle the wagons who are committed to the Assad regime as well. They are very, very scared at this point, very worried about what's going to happen. They are not going to survive a opposition victory, and they know this. And this brings me to the third point, that in spite of the fact that the opposition has been getting more and more defectors and deserters into its ranks, the army and or the military in Syria has not yet unleashed what it is capable of doing. As vicious as it has been in putting down the opposition, they have not, for example, used multiple launch missiles. They have not used, for example, fixed-wing aircraft, et cetera, et cetera. The reason for that is because they know that there is a line which, if they cross, means that a Libya scenario would be very, very likely, that the outside forces are very likely to intervene. So they've been very careful not to cross that line. What this means, of course, now is the fact that rather than go down and go down hard, what they will do is cross that line, be willing to sacrifice it all on one last throw of the dice.
So the spokesperson for the Syrian Coordinating Committees inside of Syria, the opposition people that I spoke with yesterday, said that my understanding of this has been 13,000 defections from the Syrian army. She said that's up to 40,000. There's no question Western and Israeli intelligence officials have said that the Assad government appears to be quietly shifting some of its chemical weapons from storage sites. So just two questions. One is, and by the way, that they've also moved troops from the Golan Heights. That's what the Israeli defense minister has said, or the chiefs of staff, I should say. So there's indications that Syria, the Alawite core, may be diminished. If there's so many defections and so many of the military are locked in their barracks because they can't trust them to go out and give them guns, what do you think is happening on that front? And then secondly, the chemical weapons question.
Okay, first of all, on the military question, you have to understand that there are anywhere between 100,000 and 200,000 absolutely loyal troops. And these people are better prepared, they're better equipped than the basically the draftees who are in the Free Syrian Army right now. Many of whom, by the way, most of whom, actually defected without weapons of any sort. They've been able to get weapons through smuggling. They've been able to get weapons from actually buying them from soldiers who are still on the job. But for the most part, they have absolutely no heavy weapons whatsoever. I mean, so there's that. In addition to that, the Syrian regime doesn't just rely on the military. If you've been following, again, the what's been going on, they've been relying, they've been outsourcing a lot of the violence. In other words, of course, what you would have is military units shelling, for example, districts within Homs or Hama or whatever. But to go and clean up these areas, what they do is they send in a group called the Ashbah, ghosts. These are thugs, smugglers, pimps, drug runners, et cetera, et cetera.
Prison guards, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. They are the ones that the regime counts on for absolute loyalty, because these people come from the districts around Latakia, where Hafez al-Assad came from, and, of course, his son as well. And they are also Alawite. Now, these people are fiercely loyal for one reason, because they realize that they're the first ones who are going to die if the opposition takes over.
So they're the ones that are doing all the killing, and the Shabiha, I guess, is the other way they're described. By the go-
and, right, it should be a singular, Ashbah is plural. But
oh, I see. Well, I'm not the expert here.
Okay.
I did talk the other day, by the way, to a Amnesty International monitor who snuck into Syria and witnessed atrocities and documented them following the Syrian army in 23 villages. And she said that she was told that they cram prisoners into a 5 by 4 meter room, about 120 people are pressed in like sardines, and then they take them out for torturing, and some of them don't come back, and those that do come back say that they couldn't go back again. They'd rather die than be tortured again. And it leads you to the question of how many people have actually died. The official figure of 16,000 is low compared to, if you factor in the number of people that have been 100,000 plus that have been taken into the prison system, 50,000 missing. It's got to be much higher than 16,000, right?
Right, plus the huge number of refugees that are in various places, Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, et cetera, as well. We don't really know. But the other thing is that we should also realize that the regime commits enormous atrocities, but those atrocities are not limited to the regime. The opposition as well has committed atrocities against those people that it perceives to be either fighting for the regime or being collaborators. Extrajudicial executions, for example, is something that they've been involved in. There's rumors of massacres. Again, we don't really know who is telling the truth here in terms of whether or not each side accuses the other of committing atrocities. But I think we should be very, very careful before we begin to look at the opposition now as the sort of opposition that we saw in places like Tunisia and Egypt. The social networking kids.
Sure. Obviously, things are moving quickly, and I'm reminded of the fact that the historical examples like Ceausescu and all the way through to Gaddafi, when things start to unravel, it happens a lot quicker than people predict. So we could
right.
be.
I was actually in Syria in 1989. And the thing that was very interesting about Syria in 1989 was they weren't saying, could Czechoslovakia happen here? Could Hungary happen here? They all said, could Romania, could Ceausescu happen here?
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us here today, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about China's princelings.